Hello and a very warm welcome to Midori House, live from Studio One here on Monocle 24 with me, Ted Kravitz. Coming up in the next hour, how do you create a good road? As London's Exhibition Road mixes in people with cars, we'll be asking what drives good street design. We'll hear from our Beirut correspondent on how the city has or has not managed to preserve its history, and we talk to the artist who's taking a whole new look at Italy's 19th and 20th century masterpieces using X-ray. Plus, we'll assess the decline in the popularity of Murano glass and meet the author who's convinced that the Germans and the English actually do get along. That's all right here on Midori House, live on Monocle 24. So plenty to come in the next 60 minutes, but first, the latest news from around the world with Georgina Godwin.
This is Monocle 24 News. Egyptian security forces fired tear gas at protesters near the Interior Ministry in central Cairo today, prompting hundreds to flee, witnesses said. Thousands of demonstrators had filled the streets around the ministry to protest against Egypt's army-led government following the deaths of 74 people in the country's worst ever soccer disaster. Young men blocked roads in Cairo's Tahrir Square, and a crowd gathered at the city's main railway station hoping to see relatives returning from the game in Port Said. As bodies, covered with blankets, were unloaded from trains, thousands chanted, "Down with military rule." Addressing angry lawmakers in Parliament, the military-appointed Prime Minister said senior security chiefs in Port Said and the city's governor had been suspended, and the Soccer Federation's board had been sacked. 15 Al-Qaeda-linked militants, including three faction leaders, were killed today in an airstrike on a rebel camp in the southern Philippines, officials said, hailing the strike as a victory in the fight against terrorism. Among those killed in the attack on Sulu Island were at least two members of the Jemaah Islamiyah, a Southeast Asian group behind a bombing on the Indonesian island of Bali in 2005, in which 202 people were killed, many of them foreign tourists. Record low temperatures across much of Europe have left at least 89 people dead. Most of the victims are in the Ukraine, where temperatures have plunged to minus 33 degrees. It's so cold there, the birds are falling from the sky. In Poland, more than 20 people have died this week. The country's interior minister says some are fighting the cold with unsafe home heaters.
Yes.
The outcome of last night is tragic. According to the police, five people froze to death. And according to the firefighters, 27 people suffered carbon monoxide poisoning.
Dozens of Palestinians threw shoes, sticks and stones at United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon's convoy as it crossed into the Gaza Strip today, protesting against what they saw as a slight against Palestinians jailed in Israel. No one was injured during the hostile welcome. Mr. Ban is visiting the region to try to restart long-stalled Israeli-Palestinian peace talks. The Israeli Defense Minister Ehud Barak said he expects the European Union to do more to curb Iran's uranium enrichment program. Speaking during talks with the German foreign minister, Mr. Barak made it clear that it was not just a weapons program, but also the option of such a program, which was unacceptable to the international community.
We fully support the efforts made by Europe in a way headed by Germany, and expect it to go even further in order to achieve the common objective.
Rescuers have pulled more than 200 survivors from the sea off Papua New Guinea's east coast after a ferry sank. Many more passengers are missing, as there were more than 300 people on board. The MV Rumbal Queen, the head of the search and rescue operation, Captain Nura Rahman, is confident that there is still time to find more survivors.
This is a tropical area. The sea temperatures are well in excess of 24, 25 degrees, so the time of survival is much elongated, much longer.
A Syrian lawmaker said today that there was no way the regime of President Bashar al-Assad would be overthrown if political changes pose a threat to the interests of Russia and China. Speaking to a reporter in the capital Damascus, Khaled al-Aboud said anti-government protests were not spontaneous outpourings of grievance, but rather political manipulation by other countries for their own benefit. As discussions in the United Nations Security Council continued, al-Aboud said Russia and China, both members of the body, would never allow Assad's regime to succumb to what he said were outside forces meddling in Syrian affairs. And finally, in Pennsylvania, the town of Punxsutawney has been celebrating Groundhog Day, a tradition held since 1886. Every year on February the 2nd, Groundhog Punxsutawney Phil comes out of his burrow on Gobbler's Knob to predict the weather. The legend says if he sees his shadow, there will be six more weeks of winter. If he doesn't, spring is just around the corner.
Phil proclaimed, as I look at the crowd on Gobbler's Knob, many shadows do I see. Six more weeks of winter, it must be.
And those are the main stories here on Monocle 24.
Georgina, thank you very much. And six more weeks of winter, it certainly feels like, in Europe at least. And for more details on that, here's Thomas Schaffernacker.
The weather, in association with Kuoni Travel.
And many more days of the big freeze to come across Europe. Computer models are suggesting that the very lowest temperatures will occur within the next 48 hours across parts of Eastern Europe. Also, more paralysing snowfall expected across parts of Italy, the Balkans, Ukraine by the end of the week and through the weekend. The far west of Europe has not experienced the extreme temperatures. However, in the UK, there is now an increasing risk of heavy snowfall this weekend, which may affect Heathrow Airport. Here's Friday's city outlook. In London, plus one and sunny. Berlin, minus five, partly cloudy. In Rome, only 3 degrees with a snow and rain mix. In Moscow, 13 below with snow flurries. And the long-term outlook for Europe is for the harsh winter conditions to persist for at least another week. North America now, it's been very mild on the Atlantic seaboard. That's how it's going to remain for the rest of the week, with a mix of sunshine and hit and miss rainfall. The weekend itself is looking wet across the eastern half of the US. Here's Friday's city forecast. And in San Francisco, we can expect sunshine around 16 degrees. In Chicago and New York City, a mild 7 Celsius, mostly sunny here. And in Washington, D.C., as high as 11 degrees with plenty of sunshine to come. On to other world centres. In South America, Buenos Aires, here a mix of sun and showers for the end of the week, highs of 29 degrees. But if you're in Rio, it's full summer sunshine and highs over 30 degrees. How about South Africa? End of the week in Johannesburg, showers and 27. In Cape Town, a sunny 32. That's it. I'm meteorologist Thomas Schaffernacker here on Monocle 24.
Thomas, thank you very much. It's 7 minutes past the hour, and coming up, we take a look at Britain's longest clutter-free street. But for the time being, you're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Dette Monocle 24.
Esse Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
And Monocle 24, Lagatia.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Monocle 24, Yorkosa.
Tama on Monocle Coxigumatanelia.
The Broca Jalava.
Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
And our first story is that this week London's Exhibition Road has become the first and latest example of the urban design concept called shared space, mixing pedestrians and road traffic in one big zone. With little distinction between pavement and road, the idea is that each becomes more aware of the other. Cars slow down and watch out for pedestrians, who in turn take more responsibility for themselves in where they cross the road. For some, it's a masterpiece of urban design. For others, a recipe for disaster. Well, joining us on the line now is Tom Vanderbilt, author of Traffic, Why We Drive the Way We Do and What It Says About Us. Hello, Tom. I'm sure you're familiar with shared space or mixed zones or clutter-free streets. Do you agree that it's a good concept altogether?
I think it is. I mean, I think in the world of traffic, there's no silver bullet solution to any sort of situation. But there are the examples I've seen have been quite compelling. These examples range from the Netherlands to Kensington High Street in London to almost accidental shared space environments like the Seven Dials interchange in London, which, you know, it's one of these great examples of a space where people and vehicles mingle quite freely, and there's no signs sort of dictating behavior per se. It's just that the environment suggests a certain kind of behavior to happen, and by and large it does.
Well, it's an interesting thing, isn't it? Because it requires each party to buy into it. I mean, Seven Dials, as you mentioned, the streets are so narrow, and the little roundabout in Seven Dials itself so small that cars often don't have a choice to slow down. Exhibition Road, on the other hand, is a very long road. It's a wide street, or used to be able to go down there quite fast if you're in a car. Behaviour will have to change on both sides. And do you think it's possible for people to learn that behaviour so quickly?
I think it is. I mean, especially in sort of mature automobile societies, let's say. I mean, you can have, again, these sort of examples of unintentional shared space in a city like Hanoi, where to literally cross the street involves making a myriad, you know, interchange of eye contact with the hundreds of motorcycles that are bearing down on you as you cross. And that's not really an ideal situation. That's a whole different situation of a traffic safety culture that has not yet reached a maturity. But you know, I think in London, and again, design, though, will not solve everything. There have to be, you know, different sorts of elements at work here. Enforcement still needs to, you know, play a role, police enforcement. You can't just design a street and have people behave that way. But again, these things, there is a learning curve. But again, the situations that have been rolled out, people expected the worst. Jeremy Clarkson predicted blood on the streets of Ashford when the ring road there was reduced to a smaller kind of boulevard with a shared space scheme, and indeed the traffic accident rate has declined since that scheme was put in.
Yes, well, it's not unusual for Jeremy Clarkson to get some things wrong now and again, but it's interesting how we mentioned in the introduction how it requires pedestrians to take more responsibility for themselves. I'm interested in that concept. When pedestrians are almost funneled like sheep into railings on either side, pavements, and you have to go this way, do you think there is an element of people that they give up their own responsibility for their own safety if they're corralled like that?
Absolutely, and even looking at something as seemingly, you know, benign and progressive even as the traffic light, I think there's a great danger there that it does induce a false sense of security. The most common place for a pedestrian in New York City to be struck, injured, even killed while crossing the street is not this sort of haphazard jaywalker. It's a person crossing with the walk signal, walkman, as I believe you call it there. They think they have the right of way. They sally forth into the street, often, you know, talking on a phone or with wearing earbuds, and they're struck by a vehicle making a right turn because vehicles also have the chance to turn right on green, even though they're supposed to cede that right to the pedestrian. So, but again, people have this sense of false confidence. So there is this idea that introducing a certain sense of danger can actually improve safety, when often the reverse is exactly what's happening.
So we've spoken about London, we've spoken about Holland, where this idea originated. Any chance at hitting the streets of New York anytime soon?
I mean, not as such, but we're experimenting in other ways with different ways to engineer road design. And this, you know, gets into the idea that there's not really one solution, but under the rubric of what's called livable streets, people are trying to recast the traditional relationship that for many decades that traffic engineers have had with the streets, treating them purely as engineering objects to move as many vehicles through as possible without considering aesthetic principles, how the design might influence the behavior of users, and the needs of people who aren't in vehicles. So, for example, 9th Avenue in New York City, a separated bike path was introduced, this sort of a Dutch-style cycle track, which goes, you know, on the one hand, it goes against shared space. You're actually introducing more segregation. But this too was viewed with some sense of apprehension. People thought it would make things more dangerous. They had to look for more traffic streams as they cross the street. But again, at the end of the day, the number of pedestrian crashes, car crashes, bike crashes across the board has gone down on that street. So again, that there's that murky relationship between risk and actual safety.
And what about, just finally, internationally? Where do you think has it right, if not actually going down this pre-planned shared space area? Tokyo, for example, has pedestrians and cyclists on the same bit of pavement.
Yeah, I think the thing we're seeing that's most encouraging in cities across the world is again, a rethinking of this traditional relationship. We're seeing urban elevated freeways torn down in cities like Seoul or rethought in places like Paris. And again, we tried for many years to accommodate the city to the automobile, and the automobile essentially became the king of the city when it really should be considered a guest, because in most major metropolitan areas, car drivers represent a minority of people actually moving around. So rejiggering the entire urban design scheme to make cars less of an overwhelming presence and provide for these other modes.
Mm. I mean, certainly in Tokyo, you need to be aware of the bikes. Otherwise, people are too polite to ring their bells, but you might get hit by one if you step out of line.
Yes, and I don't know cycling in Tokyo that well, so I'll leave it to your expertise.
Well, maybe that could be an interesting subject for a further chapter. But thanks very much. I could talk about this all day, but thanks very much for the time being. That's Tom Vanderbilt from New York, author of Traffic, Why We Drive the Way We Do. You're listening to Midori House. And it's time for a little bit of music, first of all. From Norway, Annie with Me Plus One. Me Plus One by Annie here on Midori House. You're listening to Monocle 24. In a moment on Midori House, we'll be talking to the artist who's finding a new angle on old works with the help of X-ray vision.
Every Monday, Monocle's culture editor, Robert Bound, casts a keen eye across the week's cultural events, taking in cinema, art, music, media, literature, and some of the world's more exclusive events. That's Culture with Robert Bound, premiering every Monday on Monocle 24 at 1900 London time and available on our Timeshift player and on iTunes.
The Urbanist is a show about the cities we live in, and it introduces you to the planners, thinkers and architects who want to make urban life rattle along like a well-tended tram, not grind to halt like a taxi with a flat tyre.
We see that our community is changing, and we have two alternatives. We could make it an eyesore in the community, or we can make it a shining jewel, and we chose to make it a shining jewel.
Leave the countryside to the softies and listen to the show that knows that a bit of grit and bustle is good for you. That's The Urbanist, premiering every Thursday at 1900 London time, here on Monocle 24.
Minutes past the hour, you're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. Now, an exhibition is opening next week at the Civic Gallery of Modern and Contemporary Art in Turin, which reveals some interesting layers in the history of Italian art. The private collection project by Hilario Isola and Matteo Nozzi uses X-ray photographs of 19th and 20th century Italian paintings to reveal development stages that each piece has gone through. Well, Matteo joins us on the line from Turin now to explain the process and what they discovered as a result. Welcome to Monocle 24, Matteo. Tell us, which works have you been looking at, Matteo?
Yes, in this project that I developed together with Hilario Isola, we went to the museum and we tried not to look at the painting, but to look through the painting. And we discovered many things. In a sense, we had the feeling that we were able to widen the definition of museum itself, because using X-rays on art gave us the possibility to see through the path that the artist walked through as a mental landscape full of places and important things the artist changed their mind about.
Hmm. It sounds fascinating. What did you find that really surprised you?
Well, we actually were very lucky, I guess, because we found a complete painting by Amedeo Modigliani that, in a way, we think it should interest the Modigliani Foundation also, because it's a complete painting that Modigliani somehow decided to hidden underneath another one.
And it's an interesting concept, isn't it? You are exposing things the artist never intended to be seen.
Yeah, exactly. It's a way to share the doubts of making art, in a way. Mm. Museums always seem very certain, but they are not. Art is not. So that's where we found the interest, and we start projects to develop those feelings that are half psychoanalytic and half artistic.
And what was the idea behind this? I mean, you say it's to almost create another level of famous Italian art. That's effectively what's happening.
Yeah, exactly. I don't know if it's another level. It's something that the history of art doesn't consider. And correct not to consider, maybe, but it's still very interesting. And there is a gray zone that historians don't want to talk about and restoration people don't want to really face, because it's where you can really interpret something that the artist didn't mean to show.
Mm. Before we talk about how you did it, how did you get the cooperation of the galleries? Was that easy?
I wouldn't say that it was easy, because it's never easy to collaborate with a big institution. But they were great. The trustees of the museum, they found this as a project that could also increase the value and the interest in their own work. So they were also very generous, and they gave us the financial support to make those researches. So I would say they were great. Yes.
Mm. And what was the process you did? You removed the works, and how did you X-ray them?
No, first we just walked through. We had a walkabout in the museum, and we looked at the painting that they were like kind of thick or uneven, and those were the paintings that were decided was worth to make an investigation on. And then we took this portable X-ray machine in the museum, and we photographed them through X-ray.
It's fascinating, especially because Turin famously has the Turin Shroud, of course, which secrets and was revealed not to be exactly what some people thought it was through X-ray.
Exactly. I like to imagine these things as things that you can find underneath the sea, like a wreck or a relic. In a way, we were able to dive into a psychological ocean of the past. That's how I see it. So they were found things that in a way they were supposed to be found, because otherwise they wouldn't have been made to begin with.
And tell us some of the other discoveries you made. We've spoken about Modigliani. Also, you had works by Balla, Castellani, Morbidelli. What else?
Yes. Our show is gonna open on Thursday with an interpretation of works of Giacomo Balla, Enrico Castellani, Angelo Morbelli, and Modigliani. So those are the works that are going to be included in the show. But the research is much longer, and we see this as an ongoing project, and we would like to contact other museums and continue on our private collection, which is also the title of the show.
Where else, Matteo? What ideally would you like to explore to get your hands on?
Well, first, I would like to invite the audience on Thursday to look at the painting in a different way. And so, you know, now it's art is becoming very fast, and images are very, very easy, and not very many people spend enough time in front of a painting. So, in the end, I think to answer to your question, I need to spend some more time on other museums and where the paintings can lead me.
Okay, well, good luck with the opening, Matteo. I'm sure it will be very well received. That's Matteo Nozzi, co-author of the Private Collection exhibition. Thanks very much for joining us. If you want to go along, if you're in the Turin area, the exhibition is open next week, as we say, from 9th of February, the Civic Gallery of Modern and Contemporary Art in Turin. Coming up after the news headlines, we're going to be speaking about another piece of Italian art, Murano glass, and how its popularity potentially is on the decline. Now, though, it's time for a little bit of music to take us up to the halfway headlines. It's French singer Alizé with Jean Aymar.
J'en ai marre de la grande sœur qui gémit tout et qui pleure. Marre de la pluie des courgettes qui font vomir sous la couette. J'en ai marre de ces cyniques et dans les frais les cochis. J'en ai marre d'en avoir marre.
Alizé Jacotet, better known as just Alizé and Jean Aymar. Still to come in the next half hour, we'll be discussing how successfully Beirut is preserving its heritage and asking whether Germany and England are actually more similar than some might think. But first, here's the news headlines with Georgina Godwin.
Egyptian security forces fired tear gas at people protesting against the deaths of 74 people at a football match in Port Said. The city's governor has been suspended and the Soccer Federation's board has been sacked. 15 Al-Qaeda-linked militants have been killed in an airstrike on a rebel camp in the southern Philippines. Among those killed were members of the group behind a bombing on Bali in 2005, in which 202 people were killed. Record low temperatures across much of Europe have left at least 89 people dead. Most of the victims are in the Ukraine, where temperatures have plunged to minus 33 degrees. The Israeli Defence Minister Ehud Barak says he expects the European Union to do more to curb Iran's uranium enrichment programme. Rescuers have pulled more than 200 survivors from the sea off Papua New Guinea's east coast after a ferry sank. There are passengers still missing, but rescuers are hopeful that many more will be found alive. And a Syrian lawmaker said today that there was no way the regime of President Bashar al-Assad would be overthrown if political changes pose a threat to the interests of Russia and China. Those are the main stories here on Monocle 24.
Georgina, thank you very much. And that brings us to 32 minutes exactly past the hour here on Midori House. Now, once the most sought-after product in Venice, Murano glass has survived at least 700 years of history, calling on intricate levels of skill from accomplished craftsmen and women. But now the very future of Murano glass may be under threat. Difficulty in recruiting young workers, combined with the availability of cheap fakes imported from China and Eastern Europe, has seen the island's workforce decrease from 6,000 in 1990 to less than 1,000 today. A little earlier, Monocle's design editor Hugo MacDonald spoke to Luca Nicchetto, one of Italy's most promising designers who's worked extensively with glass companies in Murano. Hugo started by asking Luca to explain the problems that the industry is facing.
I think the big problem, at least not only Murano, I think, is a lot of handcraft job have this problem, is that doesn't exist young people that continue this tradition. And I think this problem is really the idea that now every parent wants the sons or the daughters study in the university, etc., etc. They don't listen very well what the young people want to do.
It's a very sort of difficult working environment. I mean, it sort of goes back to the 13th century where glass has been made on this island off Venice. But the conditions are, well, you're working next to furnaces that are something like 1,500 degrees centigrade hot.
Yeah.
Is it that young people find the work too difficult, or is it that the pay is too low to really make it an attractive career move?
Murano is like a lot of other situation in Italy that is really conservative. They have the idea that this work is only for men, for example. I have a friend, she's from France, and she tried to learn in which way it's possible to work, but she have a lot of difficulty, especially in the relation with the other people in the factory, to learn more. Everybody said, you are a girl. And they don't believe that a girl can learn the technology and the process that for a long time was only men that used this. And my idea is that if Murano, but not only Murano, also other districts in Italy open the mind and they accept maybe to work with people from that arrive in Italy from other countries, like people from Africa or from China or from I don't know where, and these people move to Italy to live, I think they could be a really good resource.
Yeah, and there too, also what you say about it being very conservative, this difficult thing where they want to preserve the knowledge in the hands of very few sort of small families who have a history of working there and with this material. But actually they're becoming victims of their own cause. I gather the workforce in Murano in the last 20 years has dropped from 6,000 to 1,000. Do they not see now that in order to survive, they have to be a bit more open-minded?
Yeah, absolutely. And but I'm not sure if they have time for to survive.
I gather that actually the industry has been hit by a wave of imports from sort of cheaper knockoffs from China and from Eastern Europe.
Yeah, but this is, I think this is the wrong idea to make profit with the Murano brand. And in my opinion, the problem is that they don't understand that if they buy something from China and they put a label with Murano glass and they sell these to the tourists, they destroyed not only the market, but they destroyed also the story about the island. And this is another big, big problem.
One of the ways in which the companies are sort of looking to stay alive is by working with younger designers, such as yourself, to not just make glass sweets and glass birds, which everybody associates with the history of Murano, but to actually inject a bit of sort of contemporary design to open it up to new markets. Do you feel like that's been successful?
I think could be, but for example, my experience with Venini or with Salviati in the beginning, the Salviati for me was my first client and also the first company that trusted me and gave me the opportunity when I was student to do something in the design world. And I think this company was open to give a young designer the opportunity to do something with glass. I think the Murano glass is more close to a limited edition. Maybe not limited to 5 pieces, but I don't know, 100 pieces. But it's not a production, it's a limited edition. And in my opinion, limited edition is quite difficult to create a good turnover, et cetera, et cetera. If you look, for example, what happened with the gallery, the last 10 years, they invest a lot of resource and advertising design piece of art or like this. Now they suffer. And I think it's connected to what happened around the world. And Murano, in my opinion, for survive, they need to reduce a lot the idea of turnover or the idea of business, and to continue to do quality and maybe to work in another way and try to find the idea of really exclusive pieces that a really small target of people can understand and can buy. Otherwise, they are died, in my opinion.
Well, that was Luca Nicchetto speaking to a Monocle's design editor, Hugo MacDonald, a little early on how Venice's Murano glass industry is under threat. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
For listeners in Tokyo or visitors to Japan, you can now enjoy a coffee, a Wilkinson dry ginger ale, or our classic curry at our first ever Monocle cafe and shop at the new Hankyu Men's Department Store, just steps from Ginza and the lobby of the peninsula. Featuring a Monocle shop, stocked with our ever-expanding collection of special collaborations, the Monocle Cafe is the perfect place to refuel after a run round the Imperial Palace or a busy day in Marunouchi. For more details, visit monocle.com.
For a concise and sharply edited overview of the best clips, quotes and quips of the week, tune into The Curator every Sunday right here on Monocle 24. Hosted by a different guest editor every edition, The Curator will point you to all the programmes you might have missed and is also the perfect digest to the week in world affairs, business, culture and design. The Curator, in association with Rolex, right here on Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Midori House. Now, the current edition of Monocle magazine focuses on charm and the people and places around the world who have charm to spare. Well, number 4 on our charm index is Beirut's Jamezi and its expansion into Mar Mikael. The streets there are packed with neighbourhood businesses, bars, restaurants, long-term residents and period architecture. But how has the city of Beirut managed or not managed to hold on to its history? And how threatened is its architecture in Jamezi and indeed in other districts? Well, I'm happy to say joining us now in the studio to discuss this further is Carol Korm, Monocle's Beirut correspondent. Welcome into the studio, Carol. Tell us, give us a little trip through Jamezi.
Well, that won't be too hard because I actually live in Jamezi, so I can give you a quick summary of what it looks like and how it is. It's mostly French-minded period buildings from the 30s, 40s, 20s also, And it still has a lot of charm. A lot of people like it because it's still kind of homogeneous. And this has attracted, since the early 2000s, a lot of restaurants, a lot of bars, which has now reached a point of overkill. There's too many restaurants, too many bars. The residents are complaining. I have to sleep with earplugs. It's become a victim of its success. And the problem also is there's a lot of real estate promoters that are interested in the area now because it's so popular with a younger, bobo, chic crowd. And lots of buildings are being torn down. So it still looks great, but it is changing. It is one of the neighborhoods under threat, like a lot of places in Beirut.
Yeah, it's interesting you say that that people come there. It's a victim of its own success. What kind of places actually exist there for people to live? There are apartments, old apartments?
Yeah, it's kind of it's a mix of Oriental and French architecture. So it's 4-5-story apartment buildings with balconies. They're very beautiful, and that's why people like to live in them. And they're quite airy, they're quite big. They have balconies, terraces. That's why people like them. And now there's so many tower blocks being built in Beirut. It's very coveted to have, you know, a charming apartment block to live in.
So you're saying the introduction of glass and concrete is actually replacing some of these
places?
Yeah,
it's dire. The building next to me was this 1920s Art Deco building. It was beautiful with tiles, with arches. They tore it down, and it's a tiny parcel of land. They're going to build 2 towers on it. And this is like maybe 5 meters from my bedroom. So I'm just dreading the moment when they're going to start building, but it's going to be soon. And my street's very small also, so what does that imply? There'll be less light, there'll be less air. How are all these... There's 2 towers. There's going to be a lot of cars coming in. This is a problem all throughout Beirut, and what's interesting is a lot of people realize in Beirut today that we're kind of at the cusp, that it's really the end, like we're really losing a lot of the heritage. And it's the end of an era, really. It's the end of old Beirut. It's really disappearing, and people realize it. And at the same time, economic reasons make that we can't really change things.
You can't do anything about the people turning down these buildings?
Not really, because these Beirut's real estate is now like quite prime. So people sell their old houses, which are 2 floors, 3 floors, 4 floors, and build 10-floor tower blocks. So you make millions. It's kind of a deal that's very hard to resist.
I mean, looking at, to my shame, I've never been, and I would love to go. I will try and do it. But it's a resonance of some areas of Barcelona, a little bit of South America, Buenos Aires, some of the streets of Recoleta in there. Beautiful streets are in there.
But the problem in Lebanon is, you know, there's no law. It's quite lawless. So where maybe in Spain you might have some EU regulations that will come and protect, in Lebanon I don't know what to say.
Yeah,
it's bad.
Well, I mean, we're talking about charm, and it's certainly, you know, the city has an abundance of charm, especially in these areas. What other areas potentially are struggling to retain their character?
So, Gemese was one of the main ones. There's Maam Khayel, which is basically the continuation of Gemese, and it's still protected, but again, restaurants are now opening there, and people are moving there. It's more Armenian neighborhood, again, mandate period buildings, lots of little artisans, workshops, so very charming. Another area is Zoal Blat, which is very close to the city center, and the end of the 19th century, this was the place to be. All the embassies were there, a lot of the schools were there, a lot of foreigners lived there. So you have these amazing mansions, but they're now crumbling, they're now occupied by squatters, and the efforts for preservation have not really succeeded.
I mean, you mentioned that we mentioned...
Very negative, I'm sorry.
No, it's fine. But, I mean, it's negative in a sense, which is strange because it's a city, Beirut, where people love to have a good time.
Yeah, they do, but that's... So the problem is they're very short-term. We don't have much vision in Lebanon. We just, like, live for the moment. So we don't think like long term. That's why we don't see the benefits of keeping like heritage buildings. We just see how to make a quick buck.
You don't miss them until they're gone, these places.
Yeah. And okay. We'll realize probably in 50 years that we shouldn't have destroyed as many as we have.
Okay. Well, it's good that we're drawing attention to them. And tell us about the expansion. We talked about Mar Mikhail as well. Lots of different, as you say, small streets and small businesses. What other kind of businesses will we find if we take a trip there?
You'll find a lot of mechanics, a lot of what else? Metalwork, a little shop selling, you know, spices, old records, cassettes, still cassette places. And now, I mean, Mar Mikhail has now become also a little bit trendy. So you have cool design stores, you have Italian restaurants, tapas places, but less than Jemez. It's still controlled.
And we were talking, just finally, we're running out of time, but we were talking a little earlier about there's a street in London that's been opened up so traffic can share areas with pedestrians.
Exhibition Road.
Exhibition Road, exactly. Yeah, presumably this doesn't even have to, it's not a concept for the areas around there because it happens anyway. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, the car is still king in Lebanon, unfortunately, I think.
But pretty much anybody, wherever you want, you're walking in the streets and you're sharing quite happily the streets with cabs and cars. And everything.
Yeah. But I mean, it's much more... I mean, if you're a pedestrian in Lebanon, it's dangerous. You're risking your life.
Okay. Well, listen, let's hope. And maybe we can start the process here that Jemez and indeed areas around, we can try and raise awareness.
Yeah, and salvage the charm that's still there.
Some of the period architecture. Yeah. Okay. Well, thank you very much for coming in. That's Carol Corm, our correspondent in Beirut. Thank you very much for joining us here in London. Well, we're going to have a song in a moment, but it's 47 minutes past the hour at the moment on Monocle 24. And that song, keeping it in the topic, is Beirut and Vagabond. Beirut with Vagabond from their latest EP, The Riptide. You're listening to Midori House. It's 51 minutes past the hour, and we're joined now in the studio by Philip Alterman, and we're going to talk Anglo-German political relations, which have been strained recently following the UK's decision to vote against the rest of the EU on the economic crisis. This comes in a context of generally respectful relations since 1945, even if both nations have sometimes kept a wary eye on each other. Culturally, it's a common joke that the English and the Germans don't get on, but a new book attempts to dispel this stereotype. It's called Keeping Up with the Germans, A History of Anglo-German Encounters, and it documents the various encounters between inhabitants of the two nations over the last 200 years. Now, as I said, the author, Philip Alterman, is with us in the studio. Philip, an easy book to write, given your background.
Well,
explain your background.
Writing books is hard, but it came fairly naturally. So I was born in Hamburg 30 years ago, and when I was 16, I moved over to England with my parents. So I guess I've always been interested and obsessed with the relationship between the two countries, because that's sort of at the crossroads where I stand.
Why? Because there were some childhood influences. Presumably, you spoke English in Germany, but you had a sort of
I did. I had a bad, you know, German accent.
There's nothing bad about it.
No. It's getting better now. But you know, I've had 15 years to work on it. But,
I mean, there's nothing bad about having a German accent.
No. It's not beautiful, but. I guess, you know, I grew up in Hamburg, which is many people who've been there will testify. It's a very Anglophile city, and you know, they're different. Germany isn't a coherent whole. They're different cities that have very strong different identities, and Hamburg is always been very very interested in England and its culture and its history and its heritage. When Napoleon imposed a trading bloc on the city with England, they sort of broke it, and they've always secretly admired the Brits. So it wasn't a difficult move for me to make, but you know, I moved over in 1990. Well, I found out that I was moving in 1996, just about the time of the Euro 96 semi-final, on which England played Germany at Wembley Stadium, and Germany, surprisingly, won on penalties. So I had a sort of a sense that, there's not just friendship between the countries, but also rivalries.
I mean, football is one of the topics you touch on. You talk on many, many others. There are relations, there's literature, there's culture. There's the car industry as well. The Beetle Overtakes the Mini is the title of Chapter 5, and I've just been thumbing through it. And it's one of the things you might expect people to raise when you say, you know, what do we love that's German in this country? Mm-hmm. Plenty of German cars.
Vorsprung durch Technik.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that...
Das Auto, which is the...
Yeah, that was one of the first things...
Slightly more simple one that Volkswagen have gone to.
One of the first things I realised when I started at my English school is that, you know, that's what everyone thought the Germans are like. They're very robotic, you know. They sort of say, yeah, at every, you know, like a sort of short circuit. But, so that chapter was fun to write because once you look into those stereotypes, you realise how flimsy they are. So... In 1827, the German romantic poet Heinrich Heine goes to London, and the first thing he writes is says, oh, "These, you know, don't send German poets to London. These people here, they're like machines. They're like robots." So it's the same stereotype, but turned on its head. And really, we think, okay, the Germans are very good at making cars, the English aren't. Well, it was only really in the late 19th century that. Germany started to sort of rival Britain at manufacturing, partly because they'd send a lot of industrial spies over to English boarding schools. The English got a bit nervous about it, started and came up with a very ingenious idea, which was to make all German goods carry a sort of sticker saying "Made in Germany," which sort of backfired eventually because it became the sort of, you know, the Germans love having that on their products now. Mm. It's a sort of seal.
The mark of quality.
Yeah. But, you know, it continues like that. So after the Second World War, the Nazis come up with this idea for a people's car, you know, which is eventually turns out to be the Beetle. But, you know, the Beetle is the great success story of the German economic revival after the Second World War. But even that, you know, it would probably never have happened if it wasn't for the British occupying forces who looked after the factory, which was completely destroyed and was about to be dismantled. And they thought, actually, there's potential here. There's a sort of very British pragmatism that came out. And they thought, well, we'll just start making cars again. And, you know, Germany. Yeah.
Yeah, now they've bought Bentley and Rolls-Royce.
Well, exactly, yeah.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Just a couple of final things to touch on. First of all, the royal family, the British royal family. Mm. Lots of people think they're German eventually, aren't they?
That's well.
Do you touch on that a bit in the book?
Not much, you know. Okay. I mean, I could have, but that's sensitive, never been sensitive. The sort of part of. I mean, a lot of Germans are obsessed with the royal family. You know, when I moved over, it was just at the time of Diana, and you know, German cities were full of flowers, just like London was. But it's never particularly appealed to me.
Okay, and the other one is the sense of humour. What have you had to say about that?
Well, I'm not going to pretend that we are identical in that respect. What people in England, I think, don't realise is that Germans have that same sense of low self-esteem when they think about humour, and they love British humour. You know, I mean, you know, they imported Monty Python. I grew up watching Monty Python in English with subtitles because there was a sense that you could never emulate that sort of very British humour, which Germans use synonymously with black humour, really. Mm. But and you know, another example of that really is the most repeated comedy sketch in television history, which is a British musical sketch called Dinner for One, which is repeated every New Year's Eve in Germany and has never been shown in Britain.
Okay, I mean, just finally, I work with a couple of Germans, very famous German racing drivers, Michael Schumacher and Sebastian Vettel, and sometimes they tell me jokes, and they tell a joke, and then they get to the punchline, laugh hilariously, and it's the worst joke I've ever heard. But they think that's brilliant.
Yeah.
Does that say more about racing drivers, or does that say more about the humour?
There is a thing about, you know, they like punchlines in Germany and they don't just like, do they?
Exactly.
So, and the other thing, they like slapstick still, which I think, you know, it's a bit of a shame that Britain has lost that its love with slapstick.
All right, brilliant. Well, thank you very much for coming in. That's Philip Moltermann, author of Keeping Up with the Germans. That's all we've got time for this Thursday edition of Midori House. The programme was produced by Katie Bilboa, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and our studio manager was Andrew Carter. I'll be back live in 3 hours' time for the Monocle Daily with a roundup of the day's events in Europe and the US and what's happening over Brexit. Breakfast in Asia. The news is next here on Monocle 24. But from me, Ted Krawitz, it's goodbye.